Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFBRL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, as I said, and my guest today is Chris Rickleton, a journalist who has been covering Central Asia for many years, including a recent stint as Central Asia Bureau Chief for Agence France-Presse. And Chris is now reporting from the region for RFERL. Welcome, Chris, and thanks for joining me today.
Thanks very much for having me, Steve.
All right, it's great to have you. As I mentioned in the intro, first-time guest, so very happy to have you on the show. Now, Russia's war on Ukraine has been the main subject of this podcast almost every week since Moscow launched its large-scale invasion of Ukraine in February, almost 8 months ago, I believe. This time, the war will also loom large, but what I'd like to do is take advantage of Chris's expertise and talk about what's happening with Russia's relations with other former Soviet republics, and particularly the countries of Central Asia. Obviously, these ties are being affected and altered by the war, but there are also other developments that may be shaping or reshaping Russia's relations with Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. Now, as usual, I'm going to ask two questions. And my first question is about the Collective Security Treaty Organization, the CSTO, an alliance sometimes described as an attempted Russian answer, I guess, to NATO. It's an alliance that's dominated by Russia, and it includes Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan, as well as Armenia and Belarus. Chris, you wrote an article about the CSTO this past week, whose headline was "The Unhappy Club." Now, maybe the best way to get into this is to ask, essentially, what is going on with the CSTO? What is making it or some of its members unhappy? Is it Russia's war on Ukraine or something else, or is it a combination of factors?
Thanks again, Steve. Hi, everybody. I think it's definitely a combination of factors, of which the war in Ukraine is a very big part, because obviously the war in Ukraine has made membership of Russia-led clubs a kind of toxic thing. So being a member now of a Russia-led bloc carries a certain reputational cost, even though none of the members of the CSTO, bar Belarus, have given kind of full-throated endorsement of Russia's war in Ukraine. There's this kind of acknowledgement outside the club and maybe with inside the club as well that these countries are to a certain extent in Russia's boat. And that's an unpleasant boat to be in at the moment. And secondly, because Russia is so deeply focused on the invasion of Ukraine, practically at the expense of all other foreign policy priorities, that it no longer has the energy, perhaps, or the will or the interest to intervene in things that are really, really important for countries in the CSTO. For instance, in the case of Armenia, it's the war with Azerbaijan. In the case of two members of the CSTO, Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, it's their mutual border conflict. And particularly important for Kyrgyzstan that Moscow intervened. Tajikistan was perhaps less interested in Moscow's intervention, and I guess we'll be touching on that later. But there's this idea that Russia is so deeply involved in Ukraine that it doesn't have the ability to act as a security guarantor in the region that it has called its own for such a long time. And so what we hear is Nikol Pashinyan in Armenia saying, it's not that we want to leave the CSTO, or that we're going to abandon the CSTO. It's that we feel the CSTO has abandoned us, because from his perspective, in the latest clashes with Armenia in September, you've got Armenian strikes into Armenian territory proper, not just Nagorno-Karabakh anymore. And this feeling that, you know, this is what this organization was set up to do, and it's not responding to that challenge. And he's also saying that, you know, one of the justifications that the CSTO provided was they're not really sure where the border is between Armenia and Azerbaijan. So he's saying, well, if, you know, if you're not sure where the Armenian-Azerbaijani border is, then where's the CSTO's borders? You know, like the CSTO is facing existential questions because it doesn't know what its purpose is anymore. So that's the kind of situation that the bloc maybe finds itself. And of course, it's whereas other organizations like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization have China in it, have China in them as well. This is very much a Russia-led organization. So the focus of all the disappointment is on Russia and why it's not fulfilling its role as a leader of this organization, essentially.
Thanks. That's very interesting. I'm just going to apologize. I'm just going to, I think you misspoke when you mentioned Armenian strikes. I think you were meaning to say Azerbaijani strikes.
I apologize for that.
It's obvious, but I just thought I'd. But very interesting. You mentioned kind of, you know, Pashinyan's saying, well, I think CSTO is abandoning us. And I feel like for many years, I don't remember how long it's existed, but, you know, there was sort of talk about, well, what is the CSTO really doing? Is it really doing anything? And that kind of changed maybe in the past few years with the war, you know, sort of the revived new war between Azerbaijan and Armenia, and also CSTO presence in Kazakhstan after the unrest there. So I feel like, I'm not an expert, but it seems like sort of Russia's role as the CSTO leader was becoming more, at least palpable or more visible for a time there. But now that's changed again, and perhaps changed, you know, gone beyond the way it was before, where people were asking, well, what is the CSTO really doing? And here you're talking about members saying they feel they've been abandoned. And you know, what plays into it is kind of, I think Russia's focus on Ukraine and Putin's focus on Ukraine, which has been, you know, has been called an obsession by many observers, you know, something that can't be missed by members of the CSTO. But one other thing I'd like to ask is, and this is as sort of a non-expert on that region, but is there also concern in terms of, well, not just looking at Russia as, you know, they're not providing stability, but is there also concern in some of the countries, like, are we next, for instance, in northern Kazakhstan, you know, where there are a lot of ethnic Russians?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely those concerns, because we're hearing those noises coming from Moscow itself. Obviously, Vladimir Putin is never going to talk in a careless way about invading Kazakhstan, but some of his deputies are doing that. There was a councillor in the Moscow City Council that said something to that effect. There's Zatulin, the lawmaker in the Russian State Duma, who's made disparaging remarks not just about Kazakhstan but Kyrgyzstan. But in the case of Kazakhstan, he was talking specifically about these northern territories, where we know there are large ethnic Russian population. So I th- th- there is this, you know, who next feel, but then there's also the fact that Russia hasn't been performing particularly well in Ukraine, to say the least, in light of the recent Ukrainian counteroffensive, and in light of the, you know, the thousands of soldiers that Russia has lost in that war. And if you're a CSTO member state, you're looking at this war and constantly, if, you know, perhaps in the past, if you were Tajikistan, you always felt very comfortable knowing that Russia was your security guarantor should there be any incursion from Afghanistan, for instance. Nowadays, you're not only thinking about Russia's behavior and its aggression, but you may be thinking, like, how well would they perform in defending our borders? You know, how effective would the response be, even if Russia wanted to make a response? So you've got the question of whether, you know, Russia wants to come to the aid of these states when it's so involved in Ukraine, and the question of how effective it would be doing so.
It's very, very great insights, and it sort of seems to me sort of like, you know, a double trouble, because they're thinking, well, will they be able to come to our aid, and why am I, you know, are they going to lose this war, and what does that mean that I'm, you know, at least not necessarily supporting them, but that I'm in this group with them. So lots of uncertainty, I guess, for the future. For the CSTO. Now, the second question I'd like to ask is related, I think, and you mentioned Tajikistan. I'd like to ask about some remarkable remarks that Tajikistan's president, Emomali Rahmon, made pretty much directly to Putin at a summit of the Commonwealth of Independent States, or possibly it was a Central Asia-Russia meeting that was related, apologies for that, in the Tajik capital, Dushanbe, on Friday. Now, he spoke about investment and culture and about the large number of Tajiks who work in Russia, send remittances home. Some of them are now fighting in the war in Ukraine. But mainly what he said was that Tajikistan wants more respect from Russia, from Moscow, and that it's not getting the respect it deserves. Now, to me, it was not so much the content of what Rahmon was saying that was striking, but more the fact that he felt comfortable saying it publicly, essentially. I don't know the details of whether his rant, as some are calling it, was shown live on TV in Tajikistan, but his remarks have been viewed millions of times on YouTube. Chris, what's your impression of Rahmon's remarks? Do you think they say something about Russia's relationships with Tajikistan and the other Central Asian countries, and how those relationships may be changing?
Yes, Steve, I think that's absolutely right. You used the word comfortable, and what was really incredible about this show, if you like, because there was certainly some theatre to it, was Rahmon's body language and Putin's body language. The Russia-based Central Asia analyst Arkady Dubnov made this point about Kazakhstan's president Kasym Jomart Tokayev and his appearance with Putin at the St. Petersburg Economic Forum back in June, where you have Tokayev literally sharing a stage with Putin and explaining to Margarita Simonyan of Russia Today, who's been very critical of Kazakhstan, called Kazakhstan out for disloyalty because it is neutral in the Ukraine war, and hasn't recognized any of these separatist entities in Russia, and of course hasn't recognized the latest annexation of those territories in eastern Ukraine. During this appearance, Dubnov said that Tokayev was so relaxed, you know, he was almost slouching in his chair as he made these comments, which were difficult to say the least, for Putin to hear, given that they're supposed to be close allies, and given that Russia tends to view countries like Kazakhstan as subordinate countries. And this is what we're seeing more and more in Russia's relations with both partners and kind of lesser partners like Turkey, in that Putin is no longer, he no longer looks like the senior partner in any of these relationships. If you would, you know, if you weren't looking at the content of Rahmon's speech, if you weren't analyzing the words he was saying, you would think that this is probably the senior partner talking to the junior partner. Putin, very reserved, clenched jaw, looked very tense throughout the speech, didn't really know what to do. I think the speech had a similar effect on some of the other presidents there, to be fair. But yeah, very much Rahmon not fearing saying what he wanted to say. He had some points to make, and he made them. And I think what's interesting about Rahmon's speech is people took what they wanted to take from it. You know, some people saw it as a anti-colonial speech. Other people saw it as a typical Soviet speech, a kind of plea for more attention, more money, more investment into the periphery from the center, as would have been the case perhaps during the Soviet Union, when heads of Soviet republics negotiated with Moscow. So some people said, you know, there's no kind of anti-colonial element to this speech. Other people just saw it as a rant. Many people suggested that he was angry at the way Putin had behaved a day earlier, when Putin finally stepped into this border conflict between Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. Sorry, misspeak again. Because he'd been ignoring this conflict for so long, to the extent that the Kyrgyz, in many senses, felt that he favored Rahmon, that he was giving Tajikistan a free hand in this conflict. Putin finally intervenes at Kyrgyzstan's request, and clearly offends Rahmon with the comment about the 2 million Tajik citizens living, working, studying in Russia, because Rahmon goes back to that during his speech and says, actually, only 600,000 are there for work. Some of them, some of them are going through you and transiting into other countries, but oh no, they can't do that anymore because, airlines have stopped cooperating with Russia. And then we've got these Bezhensi, he refers to them as refugees coming from Russia to escape mobilization. So he's making all of these digs at Putin that Putin really has no answer for. And I think, you know, one of the big subtexts of Rahmon's speech was that, you know, you've landed us in a mess. He referred to Russia as the strategic partner. That's, you know, that's not going to change. Russia's importance for Tajikistan is going to be something that's the case for the near future. It's a kind of structural dependence. But what he was saying was, well, you know, behave like a strategic partner then. Where are your investments? Why are you only sending deputy ministers to our trade forums when other countries get your ministers or someone even more senior in the cabinet? Where is the respect for Tajikistan as a strategic partner? So I think, you know, this element of it was very interesting. And another interesting part of the speech was when he talked about this 5+1 format. And he said, you know, Central Asian states, we've had enough of this 5+1. We've got America plus Central Asia. We've got this format, Russia meeting with the heads of the Central Asian states. Why can't you invest the time, again, as our strategic partner, to do more work with us bilaterally? He said, you know, why don't you work with us separately on our problems. So he really gave it to him with, you know, both guns, so to speak. And Putin didn't really have an answer for it, and everyone was stunned. And it was kind of, you know, a lot of people are taking pleasure, you know, the kind of Schadenfreude element in seeing Putin getting shown up in these contexts so often, you know, humiliated in some senses in these meetings, which used to be, you know, a display of Russian prestige or power. But I'm not sure that, you know, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan are taking too much pleasure from it, because they feel that they're getting all of Russia's problems without getting, you know, maybe some of the benefits that they used to get. And all that Moscow now says to them is, well, you are, you know, your migrants need us in order to feed their families. And Rahmon again makes the point, well, that's a two-way street, because they're not just there to earn. They work. They do something for your country. And if this is the only leverage that Russia now has over countries like Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, it's not that much leverage at all, because although it can occasionally use this migration card, which it's fond of talking about, it is something that Russia requires. There is a demographic deficit. There are jobs that Russians traditionally don't want to do that have been done by labor migrants from Central Asia. So Putin was, I think, you know, Putin was clearly taken aback by this, but there was both, I think, on Rahmon's part, both the intention to knock Putin down a peg or two, which we sometimes see from his fellow, you know, Rahmon and Lukashenko are both former collective farm bosses, so maybe it's something in their character. We sometimes see Lukashenko challenge Putin in a similar way, despite his dependence on him. But it's actually quite rare that it comes from Central Asia. So this is new territory for Putin, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. Lots of really great points, I think, Chris. Thanks very much. I'll just try to touch on a few of them. You mentioned Lukashenko, and I guess Lukashenko and Rahmon are kind of two of the longest serving leaders. They've been around longer than probably all of the others, at least that I can think of right now. So maybe, there's a certain element of, well, they're the ones who are prepared to do this. But as you say, you know, with Lukashenko, it's kind of there's always this sniping back and forth and this kind of, you know, you actually need me element, you know, maybe more or at least as much as I need you, whichever is actually true. But as you say, it seems new, at least, you know, it seems new coming from Tajikistan and coming from Central Asia. And also interesting point about, well, 5+1, how about, you know, 1+1, you know, so, you know, that's quite interesting. And just in general, you spoke about the body language, and I think it's really, you mentioned the word slouch, that Rahmon was almost slouching, and that is a word that I definitely associate with Putin and his meetings, particularly actually with Hillary Clinton when she was U.S. Secretary of State. I remember one meeting, and there were probably more, in which he was literally slouching, you know, very much, and just kind of, the body language was, you know, was very strong. So to see that kind of reversed, at least, or partially reversed, you know, is, I think, striking, you know, striking to me. I think it's striking to a lot of people. And then there was another, you mentioned the, you mentioned Tokayev's meeting with Putin. And then there's also, I believe, a time, Putin, of course, is notorious for being late to meetings, and there was a time recently where I believe it was Erdogan kept him waiting, if I'm not mistaken. But those are sort of superficial, but body language is meaningful, and I think you've provided a lot of the kind of detail about what's, you know, what's behind that and what Rahman was getting at. Okay, well, we're getting short on time, but let's, as I said, let's take a few questions if there are any. Piotr K.
Hi, Steve. Yeah, there's a delay from when you ask and when I joined the stage, so I didn't hear you asking. Yeah, good discussion. Appreciate your time, Chris. I've got a question broadly about the Central Asian region, given, you know, the war, Kazakhstan is really pivoting away from its multi-vector policy and seemingly getting quite close with China. So as we begin to see the Russians really deteriorate even more, and I've got some friends in Kazakhstan who've been telling me about, you know, just how unwelcome the Russians are, I was hoping you could unpack a little bit more of the Chinese-Kazakhstani relationship in the context of the region and after what we saw President Xi talking about in his party congress address yesterday, what that means for regional security, particularly, say, for Afghanistan or something like that. Thank you.
Well, I didn't study the party congress yesterday, but in terms of what's, in terms of the Chinese-Kazakh relationships in particular, obviously Kazakhstan was Xi Jinping's first foreign trip since the beginning of the pandemic. He was stopping off on the way to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit in Uzbekistan, but he made a point of talking about how China was prepared to defend Kazakhstan's territorial integrity and against foreign meddling by any power. And, you know, I guess a few years ago, those kind of messages would always be directed towards the West and Washington. But now the subtext was, what observers and analysts saw in those comments was a message to Russia that Kazakhstan is a very important country for China, and it doesn't want to see any untoward actions on Russia's part. In terms of China's security role in the region, it's a little bit more complicated for China, because although it does have a military facility in Tajikistan, it's a secret military facility. It's an open secret military facility, but China does not yet have any official military bases in the region. It doesn't have any organization which commits it to defend the region against threats from outside or in internal threats either. It's traditionally not been very involved in security issues beyond holding drills, the counter-terror drills, police drills, some joint military drills, but there's been no indication from China that it sees itself as a competitor to Russia as a security provider in Central Asia. But I think the, you know, what it's giving Central Asian countries at the moment is a kind of diplomatic foothold, because if you think about the geographic position of the region, it's very far away from so many other countries. There's a close relationship between most of the countries and Turkey, but Turkey's a long way away. Europe is over the Caspian Sea and beyond. So if Russia starts behaving erratically, and I think we've seen at least since February that Russia has become a very unpredictable actor for the Central Asian states as well. Then at least with China, you have this guarantee, you have a sense of what you're getting out of that relationship. You're having somebody that will at least say that they don't interfere in domestic politics, doesn't appear to back one political faction over another in any of these countries, that guarantees a stable flow of investment. And again, going back to Rahmon's emotional speech last week, very much the you know, very much the message of that speech was that Russia's not doing what it used to do in terms of investment. That cudgel in recent years has been picked up by China. That's their role for the region, and it's very much appreciated in Central Asia. So there are clear kind of negative aspects of the Chinese relationship with Central Asian states from the perspective of perhaps, you know, boosting authoritarianism. That's a negative perhaps for peoples of the region, but for the governments of the region, the Chinese relationship has become so much more important after February.
Okay, and I think Piotr wanted to ask a follow-up question, it looks like. His hand is raised, so let's allow that and then see if there are other questions.
Yeah, just very quickly. Yeah, I appreciate all of that. So my follow-up question is obviously, we've had a growing interest in the SCO from countries like Iran, Turkey, and given the inability for Russia to come to the support of Armenia via the CSTO, which has rendered the CSTO completely useless or redundant, what do you think the impact of those developments are going to be vis-a-vis the future? Sort of, are you going to see more the SCO become the predominant security apparatus of the region, particularly if Russia threatens a nuclear warhead? Which could obviously make a lot of the central stand states very, very precarious. What's your feelings on that sort of dynamic?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I think, well, basically because the SCO is in essence China-led rather than Russia-led. You know, whenever you have these summits, you very much get that impression that it is China's vehicle, of which Russia is a part, but China is kind of in the driving seat. I think it can't take over the CSTO, however, firstly because of the countries that are now members. You have India and Pakistani membership at the same time. Clearly, the relationship between those countries will affect the bloc's ability to be cohesive, something like collective self-defense just doesn't look on the cards for the SCO. And the SCO used to it's now doing less, I think, at least in terms of what's visible, in terms of counter-terrorism training and all the rest of it. It's doing less of that than it did a few years back, and that's partly because it's expanded, but nowadays what I see with the SCO is just another forum, which can get a lot of countries under one roof at a given time, and what's most important for the members, I think, provide opportunities for these bilateral meetings on the sidelines, and particularly bilateral meetings with China, which will be focused not on security, but on investment and trade, essentially.
All right, thanks for that follow-up, Chris. And let's see if we have any more questions. I think we have time for another. If anyone wants to ask. Just give it a few more moments. All right. not seeing any more questions, so I will wrap it up here. Chris, great comments really on CSTO, Rockmont, and the SCO in China. So thanks very much for joining me, and I hope to have you again on the program sometime soon.
Thanks very much, Steve. Thanks, everyone.
All right. Once again, I've been speaking to Chris Rickleton, Central Asia correspondent for RFERL. My name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. As I mentioned, this conversation will also be published as a podcast, and you can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and other RFERL podcasts on Apple, Spotify, Google, and other podcast platforms. I'll be back next Monday for another installment of The Week Ahead in Russia, and please keep an eye out on Friday for my newsletter, The Week in Russia. Thanks for listening.